From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Today, we talk with an Emory University professor who went head-to-head with a Holocaust denier in one of the most high-profile defamation cases in history.
It's hard stuff that I'm asking people to do, but in this age of truthiness, in this age of where facts don't matter and I have a right to my opinion, well, you may have a right to your opinion, but if your opinion is based in a lie, it's not an opinion, it's a lie. We have to be willing to challenge that. Otherwise, far more than just the history of the Holocaust is at stake.
But first, we've talked a lot about what it means to eat and talk and think like a Southerner.
Most people group Georgians together. Yet I would assert we all have our own unique identities.
That's Laura Scarlett Hawk of Social Circle, Georgia. Here are your first thoughts.
Hi there, this is Mark. The things that normally define a region and most separate countries are clearly different in the South. You've got its own culture, its own way of talking, its own kind of dialect, its own music, its own style of dress, its own food, its own attitude to life, in a way. It is what most people would consider defining characteristics of a different nation. It's not a different nation, but it is as different as Ireland is to England.
We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Last month, Atlanta's mayor signed a measure to eliminate the city's municipal court cash bond requirement for minor offenses. The alternative would be having many offenders sit in jail if they can't afford bail. Other cities across the state are seeing similar calls to action. What does bail reform look like in other states, and what might it look like throughout Georgia? Talked about this with Marissa Dodson. She's public policy director at the Southern Center for Human Rights. And for a perspective from outside of Georgia, I spoke with Jennifer Saletti. She's with the New Jersey Public Defender's Office. Marissa, remind us, what's the point of bail, making somebody pay some money when they get arrested for something? It's not a punishment like a fine, right?
That's right. That's right. The purpose of bail, there are two purposes. The first is to ensure that the person will come back to court and that they will actually deal with the charges for which they had been accused. And the second purpose is that they, you know, will not pose a public safety risk. It is to ensure that there will be no future criminal activity.
How is the latter goal theoretically achieved?
Well, that's the problem with money and the use of money, because neither one of those purposes are actually fulfilled. And so the question becomes, when you have wealth-based detention, when the condition is money, then how are either of those purposes for which bail is intended furthered?
And the consequence, of course, is that you might have a situation where a person who has no money with which to pay bail, even if it's a very modest bail by other people's standards, they could just sit in prison, jail for a very long time without having been convicted of a crime.
That's exactly right. And someone who has the money, right, say someone who does have the $500 or the $200 or whatever it is, that individual who may not come back, who has resources to actually run and flee the jurisdiction, or who may pose some kind of risk around public safety, those issues are not taken into account for that individual. And so that is why you see the large numbers of people who are incarcerated pre-trial be people who unfortunately cannot afford their release.
So what is notable to you about the cash bail system as it currently works in Atlanta and more broadly across Georgia?
Well, as I said, I think that, you know, wealth-based detention, this issue is not only is it unconstitutional in that whether or not you're incarcerated turns on your financial means, but also it perpetuates, you know, systemic poverty. This, you know, cycling individuals like Mr. McCrary, as you referenced earlier, through our criminal justice system, when these are the individuals who are most in need of services, perpetuates the same kind of systemic issues that we should be intentional on trying to address in our communities instead of using our criminal justice system as the place in which people reside.
So Atlanta's new mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, has already proposed a plan to eliminate cash bail in Atlanta. This is an issue that is close to her. Here she is explaining why in a campaign video.
I learned very early on that good people sometimes make bad decisions. Came home from school and there were police officers all over our house. And I saw my dad being led away in handcuffs. I spent every weekend visiting my dad in prisons across the state.
So, Marissa, what does the mayor have in mind for how specifically to change the bail and bonding system in Atlanta?
Well, we are encouraged by conversations we're having with the mayor and her staff. We are very optimistic that she has taken the stance that she's taken around eliminating cash bail for most minor offenses in the city. We are in conversations with her office and with city council members to try to figure out the best language to really get what we want accomplished, which again is to eliminate the use of money as a condition for most minor offenses. And I think it's important to just reiterate that what we are looking for is a mandate on this issue, that there will be clarity for individuals that if they are charged with certain offenses, that there will be no condition related to their financial obligation. And I think it's also important to just say that, you know, there are other types of conditions. You know, we need to get out of the issue or thinking that this is just about money. There are other ways in which we can use to deal with this issue.
And on that note, let's go ahead and turn to Jennifer Saliti from the Office of the Public Defender in New Jersey. New Jersey has gotten a lot of attention for reforming its pretrial system. What exactly have y'all done up there, Jennifer?
Well, what we did was enact a system that addresses both of the goals that Marissa articulated, to ensure that people appear for court and to ensure as best that we can that they don't commit a new offense while on release. So what we did was first enact a statutory scheme that created a pretrial services department to make recommendations to judges about who should be released pretrial and what sort of conditions that they need, so that they're monitored by the court to make sure they show up for court dates, to get treatment, to get services that they may need while on release. Secondly, our voters approved a constitutional amendment that allowed for pretrial detention, which at first blush sounds strange that that would be something that we would be advocating, but we have to recognize that there are some, a very small portion of our pretrial population, some people that are too dangerous to be released. So we created a system where after a hearing in front of a judge, those people who are deemed to be too dangerous remain incarcerated up until their trial date. But the vast majority of people are released on conditions and monitored by the court to make sure that they show up for court and they don't commit new offenses.
What criteria would a court use to determine if someone is too dangerous to be released pre-trial? Would that be purely based on the seriousness of the offense, the particular offense to which they stand accused? Or could the court factor in other things that they might know about that person?
Well, we use something called the public safety assessment, which is a risk assessment tool that takes into consideration things like the age of at the current arrest, any violent convictions the person may have had, any charges pending at the time of the arrest, prior failures to appear. Have there been other times where this person hasn't shown up in court? And it gives the court a risk assessment score that they can use as a starting point. And that score is based on thousands and thousands of cases that were studied both nationally and in New Jersey. So the risk assessment tool is sort of a statistical analysis that we can use and give judges a starting point to decide whether or not this person presents a risk to public safety or a flight risk.
We're talking about reforming the bail system. Of course, people accused of crimes often asked to pay or made to pay money in order to get out of jail as they await trial. And often folks are not able to pay what they have been ordered to pay, and thus they end up sitting in jail for a very long time without having been convicted of a crime. And that's an issue in Georgia and in Atlanta in particular. We're talking about it with folks from the South and also with a person from New Jersey right now, whose name I'm going to pull up momentarily. So sorry. Jennifer Saliti from the Office of the Public Defender in New Jersey, talking about how they have attempted some reforms in this area in New Jersey, and not everyone in New Jersey is convinced that this is working. There's some skepticism in the law enforcement community about whether making it easier for folks to get out of jail pre-trial might enable offenders to repeat. Here is New Jersey Police Chief Joseph Walker talking to PBS NewsHour's Megan Thompson.
It's a shame that we waste time arresting people over and over again, and they keep on releasing them. I mean, our officers feel like it's a slap in the face because they're working hard to do a good case, whether it be drugs or car burglaries or whatever, They get down there and they get released. And they're out probably doing it again.
Jennifer, is that a concern that has been borne out by your experience in New Jersey, having passed these reforms?
It is not. There has been a lot of sort of fear-mongering by some of the local law enforcement and the bail industry about our new system. But what you have to remember is that prior to pretrial justice reform, people would bail out and commit new offenses. So the idea that somebody getting out and committing a new offense is the fault of the pretrial justice system is wrong, and I think it's dangerous to present information to the public that way. The truth is that you can never have a system that's foolproof. But what people have to remember is under our old system, the judge was not allowed to consider whether or not somebody was a danger to the community when the judge made the decision on whether or not to release them. Huh. And people who were released were not monitored in any way whatsoever by the court. So now we have a system that considers dangerousness, allows us to incarcerate pretrial those people who are the most dangerous, and if people are released, they have support and services and monitoring in place to prevent them from reoffending. So while it'll never be Minority Report, right, we can't predict with certainty whether or not somebody's going to commit a new crime. Sure. The tools that we have in place right now are far more superior to the ones we had in place before. And it acknowledges the fact of what Marissa was saying earlier. There has not been any study that shows that the amount of money that somebody posts has anything to do with whether or not they'll return to court or will they'll commit a new offense. That's
Marissa
just not
Dodson
the right
with
way to
the,
go about it.
Indeed. Marissa Dodson with the Southern Center for Human Rights. In the last minute that we have, what do you hear when you hear about these reforms in New Jersey? Are these things that could be applied successfully in Georgia, in your opinion?
Absolutely. I just want to make a really quick point that we are focused in the city of Atlanta. There are some state reforms, conversations about bail around misdemeanors as well, but we are talking about low-level offenses. In Georgia, there's a constitutional right to bail in misdemeanor cases, and this notion around carving out particular crimes or offenses for which would pose the kind of public safety risk that we are concerned about, family violence battery and domestic violence situations and DUIs, those offenses would be treated differently. They would be required to go before a judge within 24 hours. We recognize that there are some legitimate public safety concerns, and we believe that we can build a system that does not focus or eliminates the use of money, but really addresses those two purposes of bail. And I think that jurisdictions like New Jersey and cities like New Orleans and Chicago are leading the way when you think about the way bail reform should happen.
That's Marissa Dodson, Public Policy Director at the Southern Center for Human Rights. I also spoke with Jennifer Saletti. She is with the New Jersey Public Defender's Office. Earlier this month, Atlanta eliminated its municipal court cash bond requirement for minor offenses. Other communities are looking at similar measures. Just ahead, explaining school integration to a new generation. But first, the high-profile case that pitted an Emory professor against a Holocaust denier. It's on Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Agusia. This is Women's History Month, and accordingly, we're going to be talking to some of Georgia's notable female history makers. More than 20 years ago, Emory University professor Deborah Lipstadt was at the center of a unique legal battle that pitted her against a Holocaust denier. The libel case attracted international attention. Lipstadt wrote about the experience in her book, History on Trial. It's been adapted as a film called Denial, starring Academy Award winner Rachel Weisz as Lipstadt.
Deborah, I have to warn you that there's a reason why he's bringing the case in London.
I wondered about that.
Yes, to his advantage. Over here in America, if you're accused of defaming someone, then it's up to them to prove that what you said is untrue. In the UK, the reverse is true.
Wait, I have to prove what I said was true?
Correct.
Yes, but I'm the innocent party. A man accuses you of something and it's your job to prove he's wrong? it's against natural justice. In the U.S., there's a presumption of innocence.
Yeah, not in the U.K.
It's a scene from the movie Denial. It's based on a libel case between Emory University professor Deborah Lipstadt and a Holocaust denier. I talked with Lipstadt about that case.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. The man who accused you of libel is a guy named David Irving. Here he is in a BBC radio interview explaining why he went after you.
Lipstadt is part of an international conspiracy to silence me and destroy my career. And I could look up the slope and see this mudslide thundering down towards me and about to engulf me totally and wipe me out. And I decided the time had come to start hammering pegs into the landscape, as David Lipstadt now knows. When people use their Jewish networking to disadvantage David Irving gets up and fights back.
And in the film, we first meet David Irving in a scene where you are giving a lecture. A person in the audience asks why in your writing you disparage Irving's work where he denies the Holocaust. And here is your response as portrayed in the film.
To be honest, I don't think I do denigrate him. Actually, I don't really think about him that much. I don't think he's important. Yes, sir, gentleman in the back.
Professor Lipstadt, let me reveal something to you, Professor. I am that David Irving about whom you have been so rude. Yes, yes, I am he. And it puzzles me that you think yourself qualified to attack me, given that I have 30 years' experience in the archives. And my books have been published by some of the greatest publishing houses in the world. Viking Press, William Morrow, E.P. Dutton. I have to conclude that the reason you don't engage with people you disagree with is because you can't.
Now, Deborah Lipstadt, we're going to talk about all the very serious issues raised by your story about the nature of Holocaust denial, the nature of libel laws. But first, I think I just have to ask you the question that probably everyone and your mother has been asking you for a while now, which is, what was it like to see this very, very difficult part of your life portrayed by a Hollywood film?
It was an out-of-body experience. It was very strange. But it wasn't like I signed over the book and then sat down in the theater a couple of years later and saw the film. I was very lucky. I was brought into the production of the film. David Hare, the screenwriter, who did a magnificent job with the screenplay and much of the film, the text of the film, comes from the actual transcripts of the trial, shared various drafts with me. It came to Atlanta, followed me around, saw me teach at Emory, talked to my students, talked to my colleagues. And then Rachel Weisz brought me into, at the very beginning, as soon as she started preparing for the role, I spent a couple of days with her at her home. She would call me before she did a certain scene. I'd often be on the set. So it wasn't a complete surprise yet. The first time I sat down to see it on a big screen with a test audience of about 500 people, it was very weird.
But did it put you back in the mindset of the time and provoke feelings of anxiety? Was there a little bit of PTSD there?
No, it didn't provoke feelings of anxiety because I know the ending. So spoiler alert, I win. But it did. It was difficult, especially watching Timothy Spall's unbelievable recreation of David Irving. It reminded me of why this man is so contemptible. You pick up a bit of it in the clip you just played. He is a conspiracy theorist. He's a racist. He's an anti-Semite. And he lies, and then he believes what he says.
I'm speaking with Emory University professor Deborah Lipstadt. She was at the center of a legal battle in the 90s that pitted her against a Holocaust denier. Deborah, take us back to the beginning. Where does this particular strain of Holocaust denial come from? There must be some intellectual basis for it.
Well, I don't know if we can append to conspiracy theories an intellectual basis, because it's a very skewed vision of the world, whether it's a conspiracy theory about the Holocaust, whether it's a conspiracy theory about 9/11, about vaccines, about Sandy Hook, the town in Connecticut where those children were murdered, which now mm-hmm. some conspiracy theorists say was all a setup, you know, to get gun control legislation and things like that. Conspiracy theorists have a very skewed view of the world. You know, the moon landing was in, I forget if it's Utah or Nevada or whatever, those kind of things. So I wouldn't give it an intellectual basis, but what I would say is that Holocaust denial is a form of anti-Semitism. You know, it denies, it wants to deny that the Jews suffered, and it wants to claim that Jews who today talk about the Holocaust are doing this to get special privilege, to get sympathy of the world. It's not dissimilar to people who don't deny that slavery took place, but they'll tell you, oh, slavery really was not so bad. You know, the slaves had 3 square meals. They had a place to live. They could sit around the campfire at night and sing all those pretty songs. So let's not feel so bad. It's a recreation of what was, a rewriting of what was.
Now, David Irving sued you for libel. Libel means... it means that you have he's accusing you of having defamed him in writing. Libel's always written, right?
Right, correct.
Defamed him in writing, and what we mean by defamation is that you have said stuff about him that, or written stuff about him that is discrediting and this is the really important part, false. Right?
That's
correct. It's not defamation if I say stuff that's bad about you that's also true.
That's correct.
So the nature of this trial fundamentally came down to determining whether or not it really is true that the Holocaust happened, right?
Well, we try to stay away from that. The strategy of my magnificent legal team was we had to prove that what I said was right. And the way we did it, and that's why I originally called my book History on Trial, which has now been reissued as Denial, was to follow the footnotes. You know, we followed the footnotes back to their sources. So each time David Irving said, I can prove that, you know, there were no gas chambers, or I can prove that Hitler tried to stop the riots in November, the riots and pogroms and killings in November 1938, I have a document which proves it. We would follow that back to the original document. And not in most instances, and not in the preponderance of instances, but in every single instance where we went back to a source where he wrote something about the Holocaust, we found an invention, a misstatement of fact, an inversion of dates, putting people at a meeting who weren't there. It's what our expert witness, Cambridge University professor Richard Evans, called a tissue of lies. And the judge agreed with that 100%.
Let's listen to another clip from the film Denial. This is the film about your real life experience. During the trial, you did not take the witness stand, which was a point of contention between you and your legal team. So here's a scene from the film in which Rachel Weisz, who's playing you, and actor Tom Wilkinson is playing your attorney, Richard Rampton.
Our strategy is to keep the focus on Irving and Irving alone. It's not a test of your credibility, it's a test of his.
You don't think I'm good enough?
No. I didn't say that at all. Everything you have to say, you've said in your book. Our task is to starve Irving, and putting you in a witness box would feed him. This case is happening to you, but it's not about you.
My guest is Emory University professor Deborah Lipstadt. A new movie called Denial chronicles her time in the middle of a libel trial between her and a Holocaust denier, and that was... an actor playing her. Deborah, why did you ultimately decide not to present your own evidence in this case?
Well, it wasn't that I decided. I was told quite specifically by the lawyers that they were not going to call me. In British law...
You didn't have some choice about it?
I didn't have it. I kept saying, I want to go on. Look, at some point, you've got to trust the experts. It was hard for me. It's hard for me to trust anyone to take control of something about my life.
Well, also, you're a lawyer. I mean, doctors are the worst patients, right?
No, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a history professor. No.
I'm sorry.
The only thing I know about law is about being sued, you know, and being turned down for jury duty. I've been turned down 3 times, so I think I'm out. They said, they made it very clear. It took me a long time to accept it because I was really afraid people would say I was a coward. But as Richard Rampton or Tom Wilkinson says in the clip you just played, it wasn't about me, and I had to keep sort of my eye on the prize, as we say, and that was on winning this case. And what they argued is, you're being sued for what you wrote in your book. We have to prove that what you wrote in your book, i.e. that David Irving is a Holocaust denier, an anti-Semite, a racist, and that he lies and he does it deliberately, won't be helped by your going on the stand. We want to keep the focus on the book and on what you wrote. And at some point, rather reluctantly, I had to accept that. I knew people wondered why I didn't go on. I wasn't talking to the press either. And I have a lot of friends who say that the greatest miracle of this whole case was that I kept my mouth shut during this period. But I understood. I understood. It took me a long while, as the movie makes clear. But at some point, I understood I had the best lawyers, and they knew what they were doing. And I had to let them run it as they thought best.
Let's listen to your attorney, Richard Rampton. This is the real Richard Rampton, not the actor from the movie. Here's Richard talking about a key piece of evidence in the case with the BBC. The key evidence was Irving's diaries, which Rampton described as a goldmine in this case. Let's listen.
Because what they showed was, first, that he was an enthusiastic participator in events organized by neo-Nazis and right-wing extremists. But second, which did surprise us perhaps a little more, was that according to what he had written, he was profoundly anti-Semitic, which does rather suggest a motive for his adulation of Hitler.
So, Deborah, spell this out. You've talked about this a little bit, but just this is such a complicated case. Make it clear. If this was a libel case where you had to prove in a sense that the Holocaust actually existed, why were these diaries relevant?
The diaries were relevant because they showed intention. They showed intention. In the diaries, we kept finding overt anti-Semitism, including songs he sang to, that he made up for his daughter, which were both racist and anti-Semitic. We found that he spent time when he came to this country. He would come here. He would vacation very often in Key West. And he had an admirer in New Orleans who would come down to visit him, and that was David Duke. He spoke to far right wing extremist groups. I'm not talking conservative. I'm talking far right wing, white supremacist, racist groups when he came to this country. So we showed that this man, though on the surface, he acted like he was a very respectable writer of historical works, but that he had this other life, which very much infected what he did and what he wrote and what he said. So we were able to show that connection quite strongly.
And because libel cases hinge on the question of veracity, this also spoke to the veracity of your claim that he was an anti-Semite.
That's right. That's right. And again, we also showed, we went in thinking we would prove just that he was an anti-Semite. But as we went through the material, I mean, I have made the case in my original book, the book that caused the suit, that many white supremacists like Holocaust denial because it sort of validates Hitler had very contemptuous feelings towards quote-unquote people of color and black people particularly. And he always wanted to show them as inferior. So Holocaust deniers also like to, you know, connect with the white supremacist movement. So we were proving both. And the diaries really were a gold mine. And I never saw the diaries. I never was even in the same room with the diaries. But the lawyers and the experts went through them and found just damning evidence.
Your judge in this case was a gentleman named Charles Gray. And after the trial ended, he talked with the BBC just to make it clear this is the real Charles Gray, not the portrayal of Charles Gray in the movie Denial.
I've had my share, I think, of quite large libel actions. None quite so substantial, I think, as the Irving trial. A unique case. One can't imagine that there'll be many other cases, whether in the guise of a libel action or anything else, which will raise the same sort of often horrifying issues as that case did.
So, Deborah, have there been lasting effects in the legal community from your case?
I think so. There have been some effects on libel law in England, or cumulative. My trial was part of a cumulative impact, which now makes it a little harder to sue for libel because it puts such a burden on the defendant. But in terms of history, this I can speak to much with much more expertise. It's given the lie to what I call hardcore Holocaust denial. Those people who say, you know, there were no gas chambers, the Germans never intended to kill the Jews. Hitler, as David Irving would say, was the best friend the Jews had. David Irving, by suing me, and I'm so glad you mentioned that and repeated that, and I want to stress that, because there are people who think I sued him, but I don't.
Right.
I don't believe in history in the courtroom. I think they're two separate entities. By suing me, made a mistake, because suddenly lies he'd been saying and statements he'd been saying were now being checked, and people were asking questions. And just because you say, you know, it goes to a contemporary situation, the difference between fact, opinion, and lies. If I said to you, it's my opinion that the earth is flat, you would say, Deborah, that's not an opinion. That's craziness. But it speaks to that. And he went into a courtroom where there was a judge who would determine that what he was saying was based on lies and was falsification of history, which he did deliberately.
That's Emory University professor Deborah Lipstadt. She's the inspiration behind the film Denial. The movie chronicles her experience during a libel trial between her and a Holocaust denier. Coming up, a children's book tells the story of a Georgia school's push to desegregate. But first, a look back at the largest slave auction in U.S. history. This is on Second Thought.
Felt like the weight of the world was on my shoulders. Pressure to break or retreat at every turn. Facing the fear that the truth I discovered. No telling how all this will work out.
It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusa. Tomorrow we talk with the co-executive producer of FX's Atlanta. The series began its second season a couple of weeks ago, and we want to hear from all of our Atlanta fans out there. What do you like about the show? What do you maybe not like? You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk. This month marks the 159th anniversary of the largest sale of human beings in U.S. history. 429 men, women, and children were sold over 2 days. That massive slave auction in Savannah is called the Weeping Time. It tore families apart and inflamed tensions in the lead-up to the Civil War. But this seminal event remains largely unknown. Historian Kwesi DeGraft-Hansen is on a mission to identify descendants of this massive episode of humanity. He spoke with GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley.
Help me understand why this huge event happened. What led up to there being so many slaves up for sale at the same time?
Okay, thank you. It's very simple. There's a slaveholder, Pierce Mace Butler. He was an absentee slaveholder who lived in Philadelphia. He had actually inherited two plantations on the Georgia coast from his maternal grandfather. He was a gambler. And basically spent the fortune that had been passed down to him. And so in 1859, he found himself in dire straits and needed to sell something, either his land or his enslaved people.
And he owned 429 slaves?
Actually, he owned 919.
Holy cow.
And he and his sister-in-law actually owned the two plantations and the people. So he basically elected to have half of them, which is technically maybe what he felt was his, sold. And so that's how come he had 429 sold to redeem and recoup his losses, basically.
How did they advertise an auction like this in those times? And were they trying to bring in just people that were local, or did people come from all points far and near in order to attend?
All right. They actually advertised it far and near. The point of advertisement began in Savannah. There was a very well-known broker, slave broker, that is, in Savannah by the name of Joseph Bryan. So Bryan was contacted by the Butler organization, if I can say that, to advertise this. So on February 8th, 1859, Butler had this advertisement published not only in Savannah, but in Charleston, in Mobile, throughout the entire South, basically, all the way from Virginia to Louisiana and beyond.
Did you find copies of that advertisement?
Yes. They are copies. I found copies actually in the Savannah Republican newspaper. There's also a newspaper in Savannah still running called the Savannah Daily Morning News. So in 1859, they published this, and this was published from February 8th until March 3rd, daily, except on Sundays. And again, so the coverage was wide. And to finish answering your question, when the slave sale actually happened, people came from all over the entire southeastern region as we know it today.
Do we have any idea how many people, unenslaved people, attended?
The only evidence we have is that those who came to purchase slaves, there were about 200 active buyers at the site. Now, that does not include people who are maybe just standing by and watching, but we have an account written by a newspaper reporter from New York. He actually snuck into the South, pretended to be buying slaves just so that he could document this. It's a fascinating, fascinating piece. So he actually records that there were about 200 buyers who were at the auction on March 2nd and March 3rd of 1859.
Now, your focus has been on trying to track down some of these descendants. But before we get there, how much money did this gambler take in as the results of this sale?
According to what Dostix wrote in his piece...
That's the reporter?
Yes, the reporter. Thank you. It was $303,850 at that time.
That's a huge amount of money for 1859.
That's millions of dollars by today's account. In 2004, someone estimated that the $303,850 was well over $6 million.
Okay, so now you're focusing on tracking down the descendants of the sale. Why? What are you trying to accomplish by finding these descendants?
Thank you, Celeste. I think it is actually a very important thing to try and connect the descendants. You know, this is a tragedy. Oh, sorry, a travesty, a tragedy by any means.
A tragic travesty. Yeah.
Tragic travesty. Thank you. And I found it very, very alarming, personally, that a slave sale of this magnitude happens, and it sort of just goes away. We don't want to talk about it. There were no memorials. There are no markers. Now, especially since 2008, Savannah has had a Georgia Historical Society marker placed there. But even so, it is really still very difficult for people to find the information. So I think for the descendants, they need to know, you know, our identities depend on our heritage, our genealogy. And as much as we know, it's always beneficial. And I think that so for an individual who is a descendant, they would like to know, they should know. And then for the general public as a whole, I think it's an important thing that we know these people and that we recognize them for what their ancestors did and suffered through.
How difficult is it, though, to track these descendants down? Because I understand it, A, they broke up families almost intentionally often. But the other thing is that when somebody purchased a slave, they would often give them a new name, and you would lose track of where they came from.
That's correct, Celeste. It's actually not an easy task at all. And I have to correct something. I actually did not intend to start searching for descendants.
Oh, you didn't. You were just looking into the event.
Well, I was looking at the event. I'm a landscape architect. I was very interested in the landscape and, of course, the people, too. And part of it was because some of the people who were sold had African names and Ghanaian names in particular. And I'm from Ghana and West Africa. So, of course, that piqued my curiosity. But I have to say that I have been able to identify a few descendants, but it was not through my own doing. It was sort of serendipity. I just happened to, while I was searching, I found out some of these folks, and I've been in contact with them.
That's historian Kwesi DeGraft-Hansen speaking with GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley. They examined the Weeping Time, the largest slave auction in U.S. history. It happened in Savannah 159 years ago this month. Half a century ago, Fairview Elementary School in Henry County, Georgia, accepted 13 students of color, an effort led by then-principal Brooks Tuck. This was the first school in the county to integrate black and white students. A children's book released last year tells that story. It's called Mr. Tuck and the 13 Heroes. I spoke with author John Harris, whose father was friends with Mr. Tuck. We were also joined by John Harris's daughter, Sophie Harris, who illustrated the book. And John began by telling me about Principal Tuck.
Brooks Tuck had been a close friend of my parents in the later years of his life. And not only did he teach at Mercer, in fact, like you do, during the latter part of his career. He also was a member of, he and his wife Shirley were in the same Sunday school class that my parents were in. And at one point a few years ago, or maybe 10 or so years ago, a particular class discussion led Shirley to say something like this. I'm going to tell you a story, and Brooks is not going to like me telling it, but I'm going to tell it anyway. And then she went on to tell the story that ultimately became the story of this book. And she said that Brooks never really liked telling that story much himself because he didn't want to be seen as the hero. And to him, it was the children involved in this particular story that were the heroes. He was an educator and teacher and principal in Henry County and DeKalb County, in fact, for close to 50 years.
So let's do the short version of the story. Henry County was one of the last places to integrate. There were a straggler. Brown versus Board of Education happened in 1954, mm-hmm. and then Henry County integrated in 1966 right. with just this one school. What happened?
Right. In 1965, actually, we've learned since then that the Henry County High School was the first school in the county to accept African-American students. There were three of them. But it turns out that Fairview was the first elementary school in the county. And Mr. Tuck was someone who thought that all children should have access to the best possible education. And he was quick to volunteer his school to be one of the schools to accept black children. And this was not very popular for him or for the community, as you might imagine. There were many people around at that time that did not really want that to happen. And he did it anyway. And it was awfully tough for him, for his wife Shirley, and for their son Mike.
They were threatened.
They were harassed. Very, very threatened, yeah. They people called them and, you know, said that they'd put bombs in their car. They painted ugly things on the road outside their houses. They threatened to hurt their son Mike, who was also a student at Fairview at the time. So it was not easy for them.
And just in case we need to spell this out for people, Principal Tuck was white.
Yes.
And, you know, in the book we see a school bus full of 13 young black kids roll up on the first day. Mm-hmm. And Sophie, you're the illustrator of the book, and you've drawn protesters, people who are upset about the integration,
yes.
just outside of the bus, and you sketch them almost very minimally. You sketch them like angry stick figure people. I wonder if that's what you're trying to communicate with that choice.
It was, because I wanted more emphasis on the 13 children, and there were so many protesters, so it was impossible to, you know, pack them all in.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost dehumanizing to the protesters, which
exactly.
I think is an interesting and a legitimate artistic choice, right? Because their actions dehumanize themselves. Yeah. So, let's go ahead and talk about the ending. So some time goes by from this whole incident, and Mr. Tuck has to go into the hospital. He's very, very sick. And what happens?
Yes, he the way he tells the story and the way that we tried to copy it in the book is that he got sick and had to be in the hospital for a little while, and he got better, but still needed to stay there. And while he was in the hospital, he noticed that there were often lots of doctors, nurses, and family and friends coming to visit him. And as he was coming to one time, I think he noticed that there was one particular nurse that had seemed to be there a lot, sometimes during the day, sometimes at night, and the nurse was named Melinda. And at one point, he told Melinda, he said, "You know, you don't need to be here all this time. I've got plenty of people to help take care of me." And Melinda looked at him and said, "Mr. Tuck, you don't recognize me, but I sure do know you. You held my hand and walked with me to my first day at Fairview Elementary, and you didn't leave me on that day, and I'm not going to leave you." And so it was it's a striking moment that really just makes the story. The story was that of their experience was remarkable anyway, but the fact that there's this closure in a way just really makes the story extra, extra special.
It's misty in here. as lovely and moving as that is, I do wonder if you guys, as you were working on this children's book of this story, were a bit conscious of the risk that it might come across as the kind of white savior narrative that a lot of people find offensive these days. And in fact, Mr. Tuck himself in the book says, "I'm not the hero of the story. It's the kids. They're the hero." And yet you guys have made Mr. Tuck the protagonist of your story.
Yeah. He really wanted to make sure then and in his later years that he was not the hero here. And when we spoke with him about making the children's book, or he was always reluctant, I think, as I mentioned before, to share this story because it's natural, I think, to identify the single savior in any kind of story, really. Mm-hmm. And protagonists are easy to form in our own minds, even in the place or in a place where there may be many more. But I think one of the things that we hope people still continue to do is to honor Mr. Tuck's wish as well and recognize that those children were awfully brave, and they were the real heroes, as he said. I think Sophie, one of the things that I really liked about the way she drew the children was you could see it in their faces, you could see it in their body language that they were scared, and to put ourselves in that place, I think helps us to realize that as Mr. Tuck would say, they were the ones that were the brave ones.
Yeah, and Mr. Tuck passed away in 2012.
He did. Shirley, his wife, is still alive and was very helpful for us in the, as Sophie mentioned, in putting together the having images for us to think about. Their son Mike, who I mentioned was a child, was a student at Fairview at the time, mm-hmm. was very helpful as well in terms of helping us to understand some of the details of the day and of the time.
That's John Harris, author of the book Mr. Tuck and the 13 Heroes, story of the integration of an elementary school in Henry County. We were also joined by Sophie Harris, the book's illustrator, who also happens to be John's daughter. And that's it for our show today, but we want to hear from you as always. Like we mentioned, tomorrow, big day, we're talking to the co-executive producer of the FX series, Atlanta. Are you watching the show? Do you like it? Do you hate it? Let us know. You can call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. Or you can tweet us. Our handle is at OSTTalk. Or you can post to our Facebook page. Our show is produced by Maura Curry, Fenley Foxen, LaRaven Taylor, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is our senior producer. Don Smith edits the show. And Tanya Ott is the executive producer. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. Special thanks to our interns, Emmanuel Johnson, Emily Bunker, and Reed Williams. The theme music is Silent Machine by Georgia's own Cat Power. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.